filthy lie," said Goodfellow in a low voice. "Do what you like to me, Spittleworth, but I'll tell the truth." The other two soldiers, Ogden and Wagstaff, nodded their agreement with the captain. "You might not care what I do to you," said Spittleworth, smiling, "but what about your families? It would be awful, wouldn't it, Wagstaff, if that barmaid mother of yours slipped on her way down into the cellar and cracked open her skull? Or Ogden, if your pig-farming brother accidentally stabbed himself with his own scythe and got eaten by his own pigs? Or," whispered Spittleworth, moving closer to the bars and staring into Goodfellow's eyes, "if Lady Eslanda were to have a riding accident and break her slender neck?" You see, Spittleworth believed that Lady Eslanda was Captain Goodfellow's lover. It would never occur to him that a woman might try and protect a man to whom she had never even spoken. Captain Goodfellow wondered why on earth Lord Spittleworth was threatening him with the death of Lady Eslanda. True, he thought her the loveliest woman in the kingdom, but he'd always kept that to himself because cheesemaker's sons didn't marry ladies of the court. "What has Lady Eslanda to do with me?" he asked. "Don't pretend, Goodfellow," snapped the chief adviser. "I've seen her blushes when your name is mentioned. Do you think me a fool? She's been doing all that she can to protect you, and I must admit it is down to her that you're still alive. However, it is the Lady Eslanda who'll pay the price if you tell any truth but mine tomorrow. She saved your life, Goodfellow. Will you sacrifice hers?" Goodfellow was speechless with shock. The idea that Lady Eslanda was in love with him was so marvellous that it almost eclipsed Spittleworth's threats. Then the captain realised that in order to save Eslanda's life, he would have to publicly confess to treason the next day, which would surely kill her love for him stone dead. From the way the colour had drained out of the three men's faces, Spittleworth could see that his threats had done the trick. "Take courage, gentlemen," he said. "I'm sure no awful accidents will happen to your loved ones, as long as you tell the truth tomorrow." So notices were pinned up all over the capital announcing the trial, and the following day an enormous crowd packed itself into the largest square in Shoeville. Each of the three brave soldiers took it in turns to stand on a wooden platform while their friends and families watched, and one by one they confessed that they'd met the Ichabod on the marsh and had run away like cowards instead of defending the king. The crowd booed the soldiers so loudly that it was hard to hear what the judge, Lord Spittleworth, was saying. However, all the time Spittleworth was reading out the sentence, life imprisonment in the palace dungeons, Captain Goodfellow stared directly into the eyes of Lady Eslanda, who sat watching high in the stands with the other ladies of the court. Sometimes, two people can tell each other more with a look than others could tell each other with a lifetime of words. I will not tell you everything that Lady Eslanda and Captain Goodfellow said with their eyes, but she knew now that the captain returned her feelings, and he learnt, even though he was going to prison for the rest of his life, that Lady Eslanda knew he was innocent. The three prisoners were led from the platform in chains, while the crowd threw cabbages at them and then dispersed, chattering loudly. Many of them felt Lord Spittleworth should have put the traitors to death, and Spittleworth chuckled to himself as he returned to the palace, for it was always best, if possible, to seem a reasonable man. Mr. Dovetail had watched the trial from the back of the crowd. He hadn't booed the soldiers, nor had he brought Daisy with him, but had left her carving in his workshop. As Mr. Dovetail walked home, lost in thought, he saw Wagstaff's weeping mother being followed along the street by a gang of youths who were booing and throwing vegetables at her.
"You follow this woman any further, and you'll have me to deal with," Mr. Dovetail shouted at the gang,
who, seeing the size of the carpenter, slunk away. Chapter 24. The Bandalore. Daisy was about to turn 8 years old, so she decided to invite Bert Beamish to tea. A thick wall of ice seemed to have grown up between Daisy and Bert since his father had died. He was always with Roderick Roach, who was very proud to have the son of an Ichabod victim as a friend, but Daisy's coming birthday, which was 3 days before Bert's, would be a chance to find out whether they could repair their friendship. So she asked her father to write a note to Mrs. Beamish, inviting her and her son to tea. To Daisy's delight, a note came back accepting the invitation, and even though Bert still didn't talk to her at school, she held out hope that everything would be made right on her birthday. Although he was well paid as carpenter to the king, even Mr. Dovetail had felt the pinch of paying the Ichabod tax, so he and Daisy had bought fewer pastries than usual, and Mr. Dovetail stopped buying wine. However, in honour of Daisy's birthday, Mr. Dovetail brought out his last bottle of Jeroboam wine, and Daisy collected all her savings and bought 2 expensive Hopes of Heaven for herself and Bert, because she knew they were his favourites. The birthday tea didn't start well. Firstly, Mr. Dovetail proposed a toast to Major Beamish, which made Mrs. Beamish cry. Then the 4 of them sat down to eat, but nobody seemed able to think of anything to say, until Bert remembered that he'd bought Daisy a present. Bert had seen a Bandalore, which is what people called yo-yos at that time, in a toy shop window, and bought it with all his saved pocket money. Daisy had never seen one before, and what with Bert teaching her to use it, and Daisy swiftly becoming better at it than Bert was, and Mrs. Beamish and Mr. Dovetail drinking Jeroboam's sparkling wine, conversation began to flow much more easily. The truth was that Bert had missed Daisy very much, but hadn't known how to make up with her, with Roderick Roach always watching. Soon, though, it felt as though the fight in the courtyard had never happened, and Daisy and Bert were snorting with laughter about their teacher's habit of digging for bogies in his nose when he thought none of the children were looking. The painful subjects of dead parents, or fights that got out of hand, or King Fred the Fearless, were all forgotten. The children were wiser than the adults. Mr. Dovetail hadn't tasted wine in a long time, and unlike his daughter, he didn't stop to consider that discussing the monster that was supposed to have killed Major Beamish might be a bad idea. Daisy only realized what her father was doing when he raised his voice over the children's laughter.
"All I'm saying, Bertha," Mr. Dovetail was almost shouting, "is where's the proof? I'd like to see proof, that's all."
"You don't consider it proof, then, that my husband was killed?" said Mrs. Beamish, whose kindly face suddenly looked dangerous. "Or poor little Nobby Buttons?"
"Little Nobby Buttons?" repeated Mr. Dovetail. "Little Nobby Buttons? Now you come to mention it, I'd like proof of Little Nobby Buttons. Who was he? Where did he live? Where's that old widowed mother gone who wore that ginger wig? Have you ever met a Buttons family in the city within the city? And if you press me," said Mr. Dovetail, brandishing his wine glass, "if you press me, Bertha, I'll ask you this. Why was Nobby Buttons' coffin so heavy when all that was left of him were his shoes and a shin bone?"
Daisy made a furious face to try and shut her father up, but he didn't notice. Taking another large gulp of wine, he said,
"It doesn't add up, Bertha. Doesn't add up. Who's to say, and this is just an idea, mind you, but who's to say poor Beamish didn't fall off his horse and break his neck, and Lord Spittleworth saw an opportunity to pretend the Ichabod killed him and charge us all a lot of gold?"
Mrs. Beamish rose slowly to her feet. She wasn't a tall woman, but in her anger she seemed to tower awfully over Mr. Dovetail. "My husband," she whispered in a voice so cold that Daisy felt goosebumps, "was the best horseman in all of Cornucopia. My husband would no sooner have fallen off his horse than you'd chop off your leg with your axe, Dan Dovetail. Nothing short of a terrible monster could have killed my husband, and you ought to watch your tongue, because saying the Ichabod isn't real happens to be treason."
"Treason!" jeered Mr. Dovetail. "Come off it, Bertha. You're not going to stand there and tell me you believe in this treason nonsense. Why, a few months ago, not believing in the Ichabod made you a sane man, not a traitor. That was before we knew the Ichabod was real," screeched Mrs. Beamish. "Bert, we're going home."
"No, no, please don't go," Daisy cried.
She picked up a little box she'd stowed under her chair and ran out into the garden after the Beamishes.
"Bert, please, look, I got us hopes of heaven. I spent all my pocket money on them."
Daisy wasn't to know that when he saw Hopes of Heaven now, Bert was instantly reminded of the day he'd found out his father was dead. The very last Hope of Heaven he'd ever eaten had been in the king's kitchens, when his mother was promising him they'd have heard if anything had happened to Major Beamish. All the same, Bert didn't mean to dash Daisy's gift to the ground. He meant only to push it away. Unluckily, Daisy lost her grip on the box, and the costly pastries fell into the flower bed and were covered in earth. Daisy burst into tears.
"Well, if all you care about is pastries," shouted Bert, and he opened the garden gate and led his mother away.
Chapter 25. Lord Spittleworth's Problem. Unfortunately for Lord Spittleworth, Mr. Dovetail wasn't the only person who'd started voicing doubts about the Ichabod. Cornucopia was growing slowly poorer. The rich merchants had no problem paying their Ichabod taxes. They gave the collectors 2 ducats a month, then increased the prices on their pastries, cheeses, hams and wines to pay themselves back. However, 2 gold ducats a month was increasingly hard to find for the poorer folk, especially with food at the markets more expensive. Meanwhile, up in the marshlands, children began to grow hollow-cheeked. Spittleworth, who had spies in every city and village, began hearing word that people wanted to know what their gold was being spent on, and even to demand proof that the monster was still a danger. Now, people said of the cities of Cornucopia that their inhabitants had different natures. Jeroboamers were supposed to be brawlers and dreamers, the Curdsburgers peaceful and courteous, while the citizens of Shoeville were often said to be proud, even snooty. But the people of Barrenstown were said to be plain speakers and honest dealers, and it was here that the first serious outbreak of disbelief in the Ichabod happened. A butcher called Tubby Tenderloin called a meeting in the town hall. Tubby was careful not to say he didn't believe in the Ichabod, but he invited everyone at the meeting to sign a petition to the king asking for evidence that the Ichabod tax was still necessary. As soon as this meeting was over, Spittleworth's spy, who had of course attended the meeting, jumped on his horse and rode south, arriving at the palace by midnight. Woken by a footman, Spittleworth hurriedly summoned Lord Flapoon and Major Roach from their beds, and the two men joined Spittleworth in his bedroom to hear what the spy had to say. The spy told the story of the treasonous meeting, then unfurled a map on which he had helpfully circled the houses of the ringleaders, including that of Tubby Tenderloin.
"Excellent work," growled Roach. "We'll have all of them arrested for treason and slung in jail. Simple."
"It isn't simple at all," said Spittleworth impatiently. "There were 200 people at this meeting, and we can't lock up 200 people. We haven't got room, for one thing, and for another, everyone will just say it proves we can't show the Ichabods real."
"Then we'll shoot 'em," said Flapoon, "and wrap 'em up like we did Beamish, and leave 'em up by the marsh to be found, and people will think the Ichabod got 'em."
"Is the Ichabod supposed to have a gun now?" snapped Spittleworth. "And 200 cloaks in which to wrap its victims?"
"Well, if you're going to sneer at our plans, my lord," said Roach, "why don't you come up with something clever yourself?"
But that was exactly what Spittleworth couldn't do. Cudgel his sneaky brains though he might, he couldn't think of any way to frighten the cornucopians back into paying their taxes without complaint. What he needed was proof that the Ichabod really existed. But where was he to get it? Pacing alone in front of his fire, after the others had gone back to bed, Spittleworth heard another tap on his bedroom door.
"What now?" he snapped.
Into the room slid the footman, Cankerby.
"What do you want? Out with it quickly, I'm busy," said Spittleworth.
"If it pleases your lordship," said Cankerby, "I happened to be passing your room earlier, and I couldn't help hearing about that there treasonous meeting in Baronstown, what you, Lord Flapoon, and Major Roach was talking about."
"Oh, couldn't you help it?" said Spittleworth in a dangerous voice.
"I thought I should tell you, my lord, I've got evidence that there's a man here in the city within the city what thinks the same way as those traitors in Baronstown," said Cankerby. "He wants proof, just like them butchers do. Sounded like treason to me when I heard about it."
"Well, of course it's treason," said Spittleworth. "Who dares say such things in the very shadow of the palace? Which of the king's servants dares question the king's word?"
"Well, as to that," said Cankerby, shuffling his feet, "some would say that's valuable information, some would."
"You tell me who it is," snarled Spittleworth, seizing the footman by the front of his jacket, "and then I'll see whether you deserve payment. Their name. Give me their name."
"It's Dan Dovetail," said the footman.
"Dovetail, Dovetail, I know that name," said Spittleworth, releasing the footman, who staggered sideways and fell into an end table.
"Wasn't there a seamstress?"
"His wife, sir. She died," said Cankerby, straightening up.
"Yes," said Spittleworth slowly. "He lives in that house by the graveyard where they never fly a flag and without a single portrait of the king in the windows. How do you know he's expressed these treasonous views?"
"I happen to overhear Mrs. Beamish telling the scullery maid what he said," said Cankerby.
"You happen to hear a lot of things, don't you, Cankerby?" commented Spittleworth, feeling in his waistcoat for some gold. "Very well. Here are 10 ducats for you."
"Thank you very much, my lord," said the footman, bowing low.
"Wait," said Spittleworth, as Cankerby turned to go. "What does he do, this Dovetail?"
What Spittleworth really wanted to know was whether the king would miss Mr. Dovetail if he disappeared.
"Dovetail, my lord?"
He's a carpenter, said Kankerby, and he bowed himself out of the room.
A carpenter, repeated Spittleworth out loud. A carpenter.
And as the door closed on Kankerby, another of Spittleworth's lightning strike ideas hit him, and so amazed was he at his own brilliance, he had to clutch the back of the sofa because he felt he might topple over. Chapter 26. A Job for Mr. Dovetail. Daisy had gone to school, and Mr. Dovetail was busy in his workshop next morning when Major Roach knocked on the carpenter's door. Mr. Dovetail knew Roach as the man who lived in his old house and who had replaced Major Beamish as head of the Royal Guard. The carpenter invited Roach inside, but the Major declined.
"We've got an urgent job for you at the palace, Dovetail," he said. "A shaft on the king's carriage is broken, and he needs it tomorrow."
"Already?" said Mr. Dovetail. "I only mended that last month."
"It was kicked," said Major Roach, "by one of the carriage horses. Will you come?"
"Of course," said Mr. Dovetail, who was hardly likely to turn down a job from the king. So he locked up his workshop and followed Roach through the sunlit streets of the city within the city, talking of this and that, until they reached the part of the royal stables where the carriages were kept. Half a dozen soldiers were loitering outside the door, and they all looked up when they saw Mr. Dovetail and Major Roach approaching. One soldier had an empty flour sack in his hands, and another a length of rope.
"Good morning," said Mr. Dovetail.
He made to walk past them, but before he knew what was happening, one soldier had thrown the flour sack over Mr. Dovetail's head, and two more had pinned his arms behind his back and tied his wrists together with the rope. Mr. Dovetail was a strong man. He struggled and fought, but Roach muttered in his ear, "Make one sound, and it'll be your daughter who pays the price." Mr. Dovetail closed his mouth. He permitted the soldiers to march him inside the palace, though he couldn't see where he was going. He soon guessed, though, because they took him down two steep flights of stairs and then onto a third, which was made of slippery stone. When he felt a chill on his flesh, he suspected that he was in the dungeon, and he knew it for sure when he heard the turning of an iron key and the clanking of bars. The soldiers threw Mr. Dovetail onto the cold stone floor. Somebody pulled off his hood. The surroundings were almost completely dark, and at first Mr. Dovetail couldn't make out anything around him. Then one of the soldiers lit a torch, and Mr. Dovetail found himself staring at a pair of highly polished boots. He looked up. Standing over him was a smiling Lord Spittleworth.
"Good morning, Dovetail," said Spittleworth. "I have a little job for you. If you do it well, you'll be home with your daughter before you know it. Refuse, or do a poor job, and you'll never see her again. Do we understand each other?"
Six soldiers and Major Roach were lined up against the cell wall, all of them holding swords.
"Yes, my lord," said Mr. Dovetail in a low voice. "I understand."
"Excellent," said Spittleworth.
Moving aside, he revealed an enormous piece of wood, a section of a fallen tree as big as a pony. Beside the wood was a small table bearing a set of carpenter's tools.
"I want you to carve me a gigantic foot, Dovetail, a monstrous foot, with razor-sharp claws. On top of the foot I want a long handle, so that a man on horseback can press the foot into soft ground to make an imprint. Do you understand your task, Carpenter?"
Mr. Dovetail and Lord Spittleworth looked deep into each other's eyes.
Of course, Mr. Dovetail understood exactly what was going on. He was being told to fake proof of the Ichabod's existence. What terrified Mr. Dovetail was that he couldn't imagine why Spittleworth would ever let him go after he'd created the fake monster's foot in case he talked about what he'd done. "Do you swear, my lord?" said Mr. Dovetail quietly. "Do you swear that if I do this, my daughter won't be harmed, and that I'll be permitted to go home to her?"
"Of course, Dovetail," said Spittleworth lightly, already moving to the door of the cell. "The quicker you complete the task, the sooner you'll see your daughter again. Now, every night we'll collect these tools from you, and every morning they'll be brought back to you, because we can't have prisoners keeping the means to dig themselves out, can we? Good luck, Dovetail, and work hard. I look forward to seeing my foot." And with that, Roach cut the rope binding Mr. Dovetail's wrists and rammed the torch he was carrying into a bracket on the wall. Then Spittleworth, Roach, and the other soldiers left the cell. The iron door closed with a clang, a key turned in the lock, and Mr. Dovetail was left alone with the enormous piece of wood, his chisels, and his knives. Chapter 27. Kidnapped. When Daisy arrived home from school that afternoon, playing with her bandolier as she went, she headed as usual to her father's workshop to tell him about her day. However, to her surprise, she found the workshop locked up. Assuming that Mr. Dovetail had finished work early and was back in the cottage, she walked in through the front door with her schoolbooks under her arm. Daisy stopped dead in the doorway, staring around. All the furniture was gone, as were the pictures on the walls, the rug on the floor, the lamps, and even the stove. She opened her mouth to call her father, but in that instant, a sack was thrown over her head and a hand clamped over her mouth. Her schoolbooks and her bandolier fell with a series of thuds to the floor. Daisy was lifted off her feet, struggling wildly, then carried out of the house and slung into the back of a wagon. "If you make a noise," said a rough voice in her ear, "we'll kill your father." Daisy, who'd drawn breath into her lungs to scream, let it out quietly instead. She felt the wagon lurch and heard the jingling of a harness and trotting hooves as they began to move. By the turn that the wagon took, Daisy knew that they were heading out of the city within the city, and by the sounds of market traders and other horses, she realized they were moving into wider Shoeville. Though more frightened than she'd ever been in her life, Daisy nevertheless forced herself to concentrate on every turn, every sound, and every smell, so she could get some idea of where she was being taken. After a while, the horse's hooves were no longer falling on cobblestones, but on an earthy track, and the sugar-sweet air of Shoeville was gone, replaced by the green, loamy smell of the countryside. The man who'd kidnapped Daisy was a large, rough member of the Ichabod Defence Brigade called Private Prod. Spittleworth had told Prod to get rid of the little Dovetail girl, and Prod had understood Spittleworth to mean that he was to kill her. Prod was quite right to think this. Spittleworth had selected Prod for the job of murdering Daisy because Prod was fond of using his fists and seemed not to care whom he hurt. However, as he drove through the countryside, passing woods and forests where he might easily strangle Daisy and bury her body, it slowly dawned on Private Prod that he wasn't going to be able to do it. He happened to have a little niece around Daisy's age, of whom he was very fond. In fact,
Every time he imagined himself strangling Daisy, he seemed to see his niece Rosie in his mind's eye, pleading for her life. So instead of turning off the dirt track into the woods, Prod drove the wagon onwards, racking his brains as to what to do with Daisy. Inside the flour sack, Daisy smelled the sausages of Baronstown, mingling with the cheese fumes of Curdsburg, and wondered which of the two she was being taken to. Her father had occasionally taken her to buy cheese and meat in these famous cities. She believed that if she could somehow give the driver the slip when he lifted her down from the wagon, she'd be able to make her way back to Shoeville in a couple of days. Her frantic mind kept returning to her father and where he was and why all the furniture in their house had been removed. But she forced herself to concentrate on the journey the wagon was making instead, to be sure of finding her way home again. However, hard as she listened out for the sound of the horse's hooves on the stone bridge over the Fluma that connected Baronstown and Curdsburg, it never came, because instead of entering either city, Private Prod passed them by. He had just had a brainwave about what to do with Daisy. So, skirting the city of sausage makers, he drove on north. Slowly, the meat and cheese smells disappeared from the air, and night began to fall. Private Prod had remembered an old woman who lived on the outskirts of Jeroboam, which happened to be his hometown. Everyone called this old woman Ma Grunter. She took in orphans and was paid one ducat a month for each child she had living with her. No boy or girl had ever succeeded in running away from Ma Grunter's house, and it was this that made Prod decide to take Daisy there. The last thing he wanted was Daisy finding her way back home to Shoeville, because Spittleworth was likely to be furious that Prod hadn't done what he was told. Though so scared, cold and uncomfortable in the back of the wagon, the rocking had lulled Daisy to sleep. But suddenly she jerked awake again. She could smell something different on the air now, something she didn't much like. And after a while she identified it as wine fumes, which she recognized from the rare occasions when Mr. Dovetail had a drink. They must be approaching Jeroboam, a city she'd never visited. Through the small holes in the sack, she could see daybreak. The wagon was soon jolting over cobblestones again, and after a while it came to a halt. At once, Daisy tried to wriggle out of the back of the wagon onto the ground, but before she'd hit the street, Private Prod seized her. Then he carried her, struggling, to the door of Ma Grunter's, which he pounded with a heavy fist.
All right, I'm coming,
came a high, cracked voice from inside the house. There came the noise of many bolts and chains being removed, and Ma Grunter was revealed in the doorway, leaning heavily on a silver-topped cane, though, of course, Daisy, being still in the sack, couldn't see her.
"New child for you, Ma,"
said Prod, carrying the wriggling sack into Ma Grunter's hallway, which smelled of boiled cabbage and cheap wine. Now, you might think Ma Grunter would be alarmed to see a child in a sack carried into her house, but in fact, the kidnapped children of so-called traitors had found their way to her before. She didn't care what a child's story was. All she cared about was the one ducat a month the authorities paid her for keeping them. The more children she packed into her tumble-down hovel, the more wine she could afford, which was really all she cared about. So she held out her hand and croaked,
"Five ducat placement fee,"
which was what she always asked for, if she could tell somebody really wanted to get rid of a child. Prod scowled, handed over five ducats, and left without another word. Ma Grunter slammed the door behind him. As he climbed back onto his wagon, Prod heard the rattle of Ma Grunter's chains and the scraping of her locks. Even if it had cost him half his month's pay, Prod was glad to have got rid of the problem of Daisy Dovetail, and he drove off, as fast as he could, back to the capital. Chapter 28 Ma Grunter. Having made sure her front door was secure, Ma Grunter pulled the sack off her new charge. Blinking in the sudden light, Daisy found herself in a narrow, rather dirty hallway, face to face with a very ugly old woman who was dressed all in black, a large brown wart with hairs growing out of it on the tip of her nose.
"John!"
the old woman croaked, without taking her eyes off Daisy, and a boy, much bigger and older than Daisy, with a blunt, scowling face, came shuffling into the hall, cracking his knuckles.
"Go and tell the Janes upstairs to put another mattress in their room." "Make one of the little brats do it," grunted John. "I haven't had breakfast."
Ma Grunter suddenly swung her heavy, silver-handled cane at the boy's head. Daisy expected to hear a horrible thud of silver on bone, but the boy ducked the cane neatly, as though he'd had a lot of practice, cracked his knuckles again, and said sullenly,
"All right, all right."
He disappeared up some rickety stairs.
"What's your name?"
said Ma Grunter, turning back to Daisy.
"Daisy," said Daisy.
"No, it isn't," said Ma Grunter. "Your name is Jane."
Daisy would soon find out that Ma Grunter did the same thing to every single child who arrived in her house. Every girl was rechristened Jane, and every boy was renamed John. The way the child reacted to being given a new name told Ma Grunter exactly what she needed to know about how hard it was going to be to break that child's spirit. Of course, the very tiny children who came to Ma Grunter simply agreed that their name was John or Jane and quickly forgot that they'd been called anything else. Homeless children and lost children, who could tell that being John or Jane was the price of having a roof over their heads, were also quick to agree to the change. But every so often, Ma Grunter met a child who wouldn't accept their new name without a fight, and she knew, before Daisy even opened her mouth, that the girl was going to be one of them. There was a nasty, proud look about the newcomer, and while skinny, she looked strong, standing there in her overalls, with her fists clenched.
"My name," said Daisy, "is Daisy Dovetail. I was named after my mother's favourite flower."
"Your mother is dead,"
said Ma Grunter, because she always told the children in her care that their parents were dead. It was best if the little wretches didn't think there was anybody to run away to.
"That's true," said Daisy, her heart hammering very fast. "My mother is dead."
"And so is your father," said Ma Grunter.
The horrible old woman seemed to swim before Daisy's eyes. She had had nothing to eat since the previous lunchtime and had spent a night of terror on Prod's wagon. Nevertheless, she said in a cold, clear voice,
"My father's alive. I'm Daisy Dovetail, and my father lives in Shoeville."
She had to believe her father was still there. She couldn't let herself doubt it, because if her father was dead, then all light would disappear from the world forever.
"No, he isn't," said Ma Grunter, raising her cane. "Your father's as dead as a doornail, and your name is Jane."
"My name," began Daisy, but with a sudden whoosh, Ma Grunter's cane came swinging at her head.
Daisy ducked, as she'd seen the big boy do, but the cane swung back again, and this time it hit Daisy painfully on the ear and knocked her sideways.
"Let's try that again," said Ma Grunter. "Repeat after me. My father is dead, and my name is Jane."
"I won't," shouted Daisy, and before the cane could swing back at her, she darted under Ma Grunter's arm and ran off into the house, hoping that the back door might not have bolts on it. In the kitchen, she found two pale, frightened-looking children, a boy and a girl, ladling a dirty green liquid into bowls, and a door with just as many chains and padlocks on it as the other. Daisy turned and ran back to the hall, dodged Ma Grunter and her cane, then sped upstairs, where more thin, pale children were cleaning and making beds with threadbare sheets. Ma Grunter was already climbing the stairs behind her.
"Say it," croaked Ma Grunter. "Say, my father is dead and my name is Jane."
"My father's alive and my name is Daisy," shouted Daisy, now spotting a hatch in the ceiling that she suspected led to an attic. Snatching a feather duster out of the hand of a scared girl, she poked the hatch open. A rope ladder fell, which Daisy climbed, pulling it up after her and slamming the attic door so that Ma Grunter and her cane couldn't reach her. She could hear the old woman cackling below and ordering a boy to stand guard over the hatch to make sure Daisy didn't come out. Later, Daisy would discover that the children gave each other extra names so they knew which John or Jane they were talking about. The big boy, now standing guard over the attic hatch, was the same one Daisy had seen downstairs. His nickname, among the other children, was Basher John, for the way he bullied the smaller children. Basher John was by way of being a deputy for Ma Grunter, and now he called up to Daisy, telling her children had died of starvation in that attic, and that she'd find their skeletons if she looked hard enough. The ceiling of Ma Grunter's attic was so low that Daisy had to crouch. It was also very dirty, but there was a small hole in the roof through which a shaft of sunlight fell. Daisy wriggled over to this and put her eye to it. Now she could see the skyline of Jeroboam. Unlike Shoeville, where the buildings were mostly sugar white, this was a city of dark grey stone. Two men were reeling along the street below, bellowing a popular drinking song. "I drank a single bottle and the Ichabod's a lie. I drank another bottle and I thought I heard it sigh. And now I've drunk another, I can see it slinking by. The Ichabod is coming, so let's drink before we die." Daisy sat with her eye pressed against the spy hole for an hour, until Ma Grunter came and banged on the hatch with her cane.
"What is your name?"
"Daisy Dovetail,"
bellowed Daisy. And every hour afterwards, the question came, and the answer remained the same. However, as the hours wore by, Daisy began to feel light-headed with hunger. Every time she shouted, "Daisy Dovetail," back at Ma Grunter, her voice was weaker. At last, she saw through her spyhole in the attic that it was becoming dark. She was very thirsty now, and she had to face the fact that if she kept refusing to say her name was Jane, there really might be a skeleton in the attic for Basher John to frighten other children with. So the next time Ma Grunter banged on the attic hatch with her cane and asked what Daisy's name was, she answered, "Jane."
"And is your father alive?" asked Ma Grunter.
Daisy crossed her fingers and said,
"No." "Very good,"
said Ma Grunter, pulling open the hatch so that the rope ladder fell down.
Come down here, Jane.
When Daisy was standing beside her again, the old lady cuffed her around the ear.
That's for being a nasty, lying, filthy little brat. Now, go and drink your soup, wash up the bowl, then get to bed.
Daisy gulped down a small bowl of cabbage soup, which was the nastiest thing she'd ever eaten, washed the bowl in the greasy barrel that Ma Grunter kept for doing dishes, then went back upstairs. There was a spare mattress on the floor of the girls' bedroom, so she crept inside while all the other girls watched her and got under the threadbare blanket, fully dressed, because the room was very cold. Daisy found herself looking into the kind blue eyes of a girl her own age, with a gaunt face.
"You lasted much longer than most," whispered the girl. She had an accent Daisy had never heard before.
Later, Daisy would learn that the girl was a marshlander.
"What's your name?" Daisy whispered. "Your real name."
The girl considered Daisy with those huge forget-me-not eyes.
"We're not allowed to say."
"I promise I won't tell," whispered Daisy. The girl stared at her. Just when Daisy thought she wasn't going to answer, the girl whispered,
"Martha." "Pleased to meet you, Martha," whispered Daisy. "I'm Daisy Dovetail, and my father's still alive."
Chapter 29. Mrs. Beamish Worries. Back in Shoeville, Spittleworth made sure the story was circulated that the Dovetail family had packed up in the middle of the night and moved to the neighbouring country of Pluritania. Daisy's former teacher told her old classmates, and Cankerby the footman informed all the palace servants. After he got home from school that day, Bert went and lay on his bed, staring up at the ceiling. He was thinking back to the days when he'd been a small, plump boy whom the other children called Butterball, and how Daisy had always stuck up for him. He remembered their long-ago fight in the palace courtyard and the expression on Daisy's face when he'd accidentally knocked her hopes of heaven to the ground on her birthday. Then Bert considered the way he spent his break times these days. At first, Bert had sort of liked being friends with Roderick Roach, because Roderick used to bully him, and he was glad he'd stopped. But if he was truly honest with himself, Bert didn't really enjoy the same things that Roderick did. For instance, trying to hit stray dogs with catapults, or finding live frogs to hide in the girls' satchels. In fact, the more he remembered the fun he used to have with Daisy, the more he thought about how his face ached from fake smiling at the end of a day with Roderick, and the more Bert regretted that he'd never tried to repair his and Daisy's friendship. But it was too late now. Daisy was gone forever, gone to Pluritania. While Bert was lying on his bed, Mrs. Beamish sat alone in the kitchen. She felt almost as bad as her son. Ever since she had done it, Mrs. Beamish had regretted telling the scullery maid what Mr. Dovetail had said about the Ichabod not being real. She had been so angry at the suggestion that her husband might have fallen off his horse, she hadn't realized she was reporting treason until the words were out of her mouth and it was too late to call them back. She really hadn't wanted to get such an old friend into trouble, so she'd begged the scullery maid to forget what she had said, and Mabel had agreed. Relieved, Mrs. Beamish had turned around to take a large batch of Maiden's Dreams out of the oven, then spotted Cankerby, the footman, skulking in the corner. Cankerby was known to everyone who worked at the palace as a sneak and a tattletale. He had a knack of arriving noiselessly in rooms and peeping unnoticed through keyholes. Mrs. Beamish didn't dare ask Cankerby how long he'd been standing there, but now, sitting alone at her own kitchen table, a terrible fear gripped her heart. Had news of Mr. Dovetail's treason been carried by Cankerby to Lord Spittleworth? Was it possible that Mr. Dovetail had gone not to Pluritania, but to prison? The longer she thought about it, the more frightened she became, until finally Mrs. Beamish called out to Bert that she was going for an evening stroll and hurried from the house. There were still children playing in the streets, and Mrs. Beamish wound her way in and out of them until she reached the small cottage that lay between the city within the city gates and the graveyard. The windows were dark and the workshop locked up, but when Mrs. Beamish gave the front door a gentle push, it opened. All the furniture was gone, right down to the pictures on the walls. Mrs. Beamish let out a long, slow sigh of relief. If they'd slung Mr. Dovetail in jail, they'd hardly have put all his furniture in there with him. It really did look as though he'd packed up and taken Daisy off to Pluritania. Mrs. Beamish felt a little easier in her mind as she walked back through the city within the city. Some little girls were jumping rope in the road up ahead, chanting a rhyme now repeated in playgrounds all over the kingdom. Ichabod, Ichabod, he'll get you if you stop. Ichabod, Ichabod, so skip until you flop. Never look back if you feel squeamish, 'cause he's caught a soldier called Major. One of the little girls turning the rope for her friend spotted Mrs. Beamish, let out a squeal, and dropped her end. The other little girls turned too, and seeing the pastry chef, all of them turned red. One let out a terrified giggle, and another burst into tears. "It's all right, girls," said Mrs. Beamish, trying to smile. "It doesn't matter." The children remained quite still as she passed them, until suddenly Mrs. Beamish turned to look again at the girl who had dropped the end of the skipping rope. "Where," asked Mrs. Beamish, "did you get that dress?" The scarlet-faced little girl looked down at it, then back up at Mrs. Beamish. "My daddy gave it to me, missus," said the girl, "when he came home from work yesterday, and he gave my brother a bandolore." After staring at the dress for a few more seconds, Mrs. Beamish turned slowly away and walked on home. She told herself she must be mistaken, but she was sure she could remember Daisy Dovetail wearing a beautiful little dress exactly like that, sunshine yellow with daisies embroidered around the neck and cuffs, back when her mother was alive and made all Daisy's clothes. Chapter 30. The Foot. A month passed. Deep in the dungeons, Mr. Dovetail worked in a kind of frenzy. He had to finish the monstrous wooden foot so he could see Daisy again. He'd forced himself to believe that Spittleworth would keep his word and let him leave the dungeon after he'd completed his task, even though a voice in his head kept saying, "They'll never let you go after this. Never." To drive out fear, Mr. Dovetail started singing the national anthem over and over again. "Cornucopia, give praises to the king. Cornucopia, lift up your voice and sing." His constant singing annoyed the other prisoners even more than the sound of his chisel and hammer. The now thin and ragged Captain Goodfellow begged him to stop, but Mr. Dovetail paid no attention. He'd become a little delirious. He had a confused idea that if he showed himself a faithful subject of the king, Spittleworth might think him less of a danger and release him. So the carpenter's cell rang with the banging and scraping of his tools and the national anthem, and slowly but surely a monstrous clawed foot took shape, with a long handle out of the top, so that a man on horseback could press it deep into soft ground. When at last the wooden foot was finished, Spittleworth, Flapoon, and Major Roach came down into the dungeons to inspect it. "Yes," said Spittleworth slowly, examining the foot from every angle. "Very good indeed. What do you think, Roach?"
"I think that'll do very nicely, my lord," replied the major.
"You've done well, Dovetail," Spittleworth told the carpenter. "I'll tell the warder to give you extra rations tonight."
"But you said I'd go free when I finished," said Mr. Dovetail, falling to his knees, pale and exhausted. "Please, my lord, please, I have to see my daughter, please!"
Mr. Dovetail reached for Lord Spittleworth's bony hand, but Spittleworth snatched it back.
"Don't touch me, traitor. You should be grateful I didn't have you put to death. I may yet if this foot doesn't do the trick, so if I were you, I'd pray my plan works."
Chapter 31. Disappearance of a Butcher. That night, under cover of darkness, a party of horsemen dressed all in black rode out from Shoeville, headed by Major Roach. Hidden beneath a large bit of sacking on a wagon in their midst was the gigantic wooden foot, with its carved scales and long, sharp claws. At last, they reached the outskirts of Baronstown. Now the riders, members of the Ichabod Defence Brigade, whom Spittleworth had chosen for the job, slipped from their horses and covered the animals' hooves with sacking to muffle the noise and the shape of their prints. Then they lifted the giant foot off the wagon, remounted, and carried it between them to the house where Tubby Tenderloin, the butcher, lived with his wife, which was luckily a little distance from its neighbours. Several of the soldiers now tied up their horses, stole up to Tubby's back door, and forced entry, while the rest pressed the giant foot into the mud around his back gate. 5 minutes after the soldiers arrived, they carried Tubby and his wife, who had no children, out of their house, bound and gagged, and threw them onto the wagon. I may as well tell you now that Tubby and his wife were about to be killed, their bodies buried in the woods, in exactly the way Private Prod had been supposed to dispose of Daisy. Spittleworth only kept alive those people for whom he had a use. Mr. Dovetail might need to repair the Ichabod foot if it got damaged, and Captain Goodfellow and his friends might need to be dragged out again some day to repeat their lies about the Ichabod. Spittleworth couldn't imagine ever needing a treasonous sausage maker, though, so he'd ordered his murder. As for poor Mrs. Tenderloin, Spittleworth barely considered her at all, but I'd like you to know that she was a very kind person who babysat her friend's children and sang in the local choir. Once the Tenderloins had been taken away, the remaining soldiers entered the house and smashed up the furniture as though a giant creature had wrecked it, while the rest of the men broke down the back fence and pressed the giant foot